Stories of Disaster.
The diary wound up on the floor of the attic after the Franks were taken away, and immediately after they were arrested, Mikis and one of the other helpers, Zep, and one of the warehousemen went up and gathered up all the papers, and Mikis kept them in her drawer to save them for Anne's return.
That's Francine Prose. We'll talk to her about her terrific new book about Anne Frank's diary.
My parents' experience made them very vulnerable to any suffering, very attentive to the suffering of the Palestinians.
And that's Israeli journalist Amira Haas. We'll talk with her about her mother's diary of Bergen-Belsen and how her experience there motivated her to defend the rights of others after the war. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Most years at this time, I air a program commemorating the Night of Broken Glass. That was the anti-Jewish pogrom in Nazi Germany and Austria that took place on November 9th and 10th, 1938. For those Jews who had tried to convince themselves that the Nazis were more bark than bite, the pogrom was a wake-up call, but too late for most. By 1938, it was almost impossible to get out of Nazi Germany or to get a visa to a safe country of refuge. Otto Frank, the father of Anne Frank, was much more farsighted than most German Jews. Already by 1933, he'd moved himself and his wife and two daughters to Holland. But in 1940, the Germans overran Holland, and Otto knew he had to once again plan for his family's safety. The story of their move to the Annex, a hidden wing over Frank's business on one of Amsterdam's oldest canals, has come to us through the words of his gifted and doomed daughter, Anne. She died in Bergen-Belsen in 1945. Francine Prose is a writer's writer. Francine Prose is a writer's writer. In addition to fiction, she's written about other writers, most notably in her book, Reading Like a Writer, which we interviewed her about on this show. Now she's turned her attention to the diary of Anne Frank and how it's been seen since it was first published in 1947. She says over the course of her time in the Annex, Anne became an extraordinarily accomplished writer, using literary devices like addressing the diary to an imaginary friend, Kitty, and reworking earlier passages to make them tighter and more compelling. Francine Prose's new book is Anne Frank, The Book, The Life, The Afterlife. Well, Francine Prose, welcome again to Writer's Voice. With so much written about Anne Frank, why did you want to write this book?
Well, I reread the diary within the last couple of years, and I was struck in a way that I couldn't have realized when I first read it when I was a kid. Really, what a great book it was, what a literary masterpiece it was. And it seemed to me that even though the diary has been read by millions of readers and translated into languages all over the world and published in any number of editions, that Anne Frank had not gotten enough credit as a writer. So I really wanted to bring a writer's eye to the diary and to just call attention to the kinds of, to really her skill and the literary devices that she used, even though it's a diary and, you know, scenes and narrations and dialogue, and how difficult was this seemingly effortless, artless achievement of writing this book.
And a young girl as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, a girl between the ages of 13 and 15. I mean, as I say in the book, not a demographic that we ordinarily associate with literary genius, but in her case, that was obviously true.
Describe to us what her surroundings were at the time. You've been to the Anne Frank House. It's been kept the way it was once it was cleared out after their arrest. Tell us what it might have been like when they were there, when she, her parents, her sister, and the others were there.
It was a very small space that she shared with her mother and her father and her sister and the Van Pelses and their son Peter and the dentist. So those were eight people, really seven adults, two of them teenagers and one child, or one girl who grew from a child into a teenager, living in a very cramped small space, really a few rooms, hidden in an annex, an attic really behind her father's warehouse. I mean, it was fairly customary in Amsterdam for people to build these annexes onto their structures because the facades of the house were were so narrow just because of the plan of the city that in order to have extra room, they would sometimes build above and behind the house. In many cases, these additions were invisible from the street. So that when it became clear that Anne and her family were going to have to go into hiding, her father's employees set about making the attic and the annex above the business, which was a Spice and Pecton warehouse and business, basically habitable. So they put in the plumbing and turned the situation into rooms in which the families could live.
And, of course, most of us know something of who the Franks were, but that knowledge usually is mediated by the play, the movie, and then the book that most people probably read when they're in high school or even grade school.
Well, the book that they should be reading again and again, really. I mean, it really is quite an experience to reread it as an adult, because there is so much, you know, as with every great classic that you read as a younger person, so much that you miss. And really, it's a masterpiece. I mean, that's what I noticed, and that's what I set out to talk about.
You did it beautifully. But before we get to the diary itself, tell us something of who the Franks were, who they were before they went to the secret annex.
Well, Otto came from a prosperous, essentially prosperous banking family, a Jewish banking family in Frankfurt in Germany. He started out in quite more comfortable circumstances than he was even before he went into hiding. That is, his father had a bank, and during the many historical crises between the First and Second World War, devaluation, the rise of National Socialism, and then several private, you know, particular individual problems, the bank went under. And he originally came to Holland to set up a Dutch branch of the bank, which was not successful, but he made friends in Holland and got to like the country very much. And then when Nazism was on the rise and it was clear that he and his family could no longer survive in Germany, Holland suggested itself as a place he could go where he knew people, where he could get help. And his cousin, who was then in Switzerland, was working was working for this Pecton supplier, and Otto essentially became the Dutch representative. So consequently, he was able to move the family to Holland, where there were quite a number of Jewish refugees from Germany, a number that would grow throughout the next few years, and to set up really a house and a business and a life before everything became impossible.
The noose around the Jews tightened slowly and steadily. And actually, it's my father who witnessed all of this. He was in Amsterdam at the time. He described it as the kind of thing where you put, you know, a frog into the water and you turn up the heat just a little bit and a little bit more and a little bit more until people are boiled.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, one regulation after another, no bicycles, no theaters, no movies, no parks, no sitting outside after 8 p.m., you know, designed in the most demonic, calculated way to make life unbearable and impossible for people.
Now, Holland does have a reputation, and I think that reputation has probably been built at least partly by the Israelis through Yad Vashem, who have honored so many of the Dutch resistors, but they were a very, very tiny, perhaps 1% of the population. Tell us who were the benefactors of the Franks. Tell us about them, Miep Ries and her husband and the others.
Well, Miep was originally Austrian. She'd come to Holland in a program after World War One, when there was a lot of starvation, really, in Austria. So there was a kind of a program that brought Austrian children to live with Dutch families where the economic conditions were better. So she was adopted by a Dutch family, or lived with a Dutch family, and then was essentially adopted and took on a Dutch name. Jan Gies, her husband, was Dutch, so she married a Dutch man and thought of herself really as Dutch. And they were simply people with consciences and people who were, you know, extraordinarily brave because it was so dangerous. And there were several very close calls, some of which Anne documents in the diary. And then the people who worked for Otto Frank, were just, they, you know, they were very fond of him. They were very brave. They had a sense of right and wrong, and they did what was necessary to preserve the family's life and the other family's life.
And yet, Meet Geese, she said in her own memoir, which I think is Anne Frank Remembered, is that correct?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
She said that she was not a hero.
Well, she's also extremely modest. I mean, there's a great documentary, also I think called Anne Frank Remembered by John Blair, in which Meep appears, and she begins essentially by apologizing for her English, which is actually quite marvelous. So one gets the sense that she was not only remarkably courageous and a person of enormous conscience, but modest in addition.
Okay, now we have a picture, a bit of that time, not yet quite of the terror that was experienced by the Franks as they were shut up in their annex. Let's jump actually to the end, because I think that's a way into the diary itself. Tell us about the arrest of the Franks on August 4th, 1944, and how the diary survived it.
Well, the Green Police, the dreaded Nazi, the version of the Gestapo really in Holland, arrived presumably tipped off by, I mean, and there's been endless debate about who exactly betrayed the Franks. Some people say one of the warehouse workers, other people say a neighbor, so forth and so on. In any case, they were betrayed. It was clear when the police showed up that they knew how many people were in the attic and where the attic was and how to detach the bookcase behind which the attic was hidden. They went up, and it was customary, of course, for all the jewels and money of the arrested Jews to be seized. So the police said, okay, you know, we need something to put whatever cash they have or jewels, and there was a briefcase on the floor. Now, the briefcase was where Anne kept her diary and the papers on which she was rewriting the diary, and the police stupidly emptied out the papers out of the briefcase so that they could fill it with whatever they, you know, seemed to be of more value. So in that way, the diary wound up on the floor of the attic after the Franks were taken away, and immediately after they were arrested, Meet Geese and one of the other helpers, Bep, and one of the warehousemen went up and gathered up all the papers, and Meet kept them in her drawer to save them for Anne's return.
Now, this was a really extraordinary act, actually, to keep a diary during the war. In my the group that my father was a member of, and just briefly to tell our listeners, my father was in the Dutch resistance. I have seen the diaries of the people who are in that group, and they end with the beginning of the war, and they only return after the end of the war. So everybody knew that Anne was keeping this diary. That must have been an incredible act of courage on all of their parts. And does that say to you something about the respect that they must have held in some way for it as well?
Well, what's extraordinary, really, among the amazing things about the diary and about the people that Anne wrote about, was the amount of decency and the high level of civilization and respect for one another that was maintained even under these extreme brutalizing circumstances, really. So, yes, they all knew she was writing the diary. Yes, the people in the attic knew she was writing about them. Also, it was quite dangerous after the arrest. I mean, Meep, I think, understood very well that had the diary been found, it would have been all too easy to figure out who had been helping them and how they had been able to survive for 25 months in hiding. So, in fact, when she first retrieved the diary, she locked it up on her desk. And then she became concerned that the Germans might wonder why someone thought the diary of a child would be worth locking up. So she just kept it in a drawer, essentially, until Otto returned from Auschwitz.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Francine Prose about her new book, Anne Frank, The Book, The Life, The Afterlife. In this diary here, as you say, it was written both, it was a diary that she was given at the age of 13 for her birthday, a small red and gray and white check diary, and then there were other papers as well. There ended up being three versions of the diary, two that Anne did and one that her father did. Tell us about them.
Well, Anne originally began writing. She got the diary for her 13th birthday, which was in the spring of 1942, and she began writing in that little checked volume that everyone thinks of as the diary. And she filled it and then left a few pages blank, which she would fill in later. Then she began to write in exercise books, which the helpers brought her when she was in the secret annex. then in the spring of 1944, so this was already almost 2 years later, a year and a half later, the families heard a radio broadcast in which the Dutch Minister of Culture in Exile suggested that ordinary Dutch citizens keep their letters and diaries and papers so that people would, in the future would know what the Dutch had gone through during the war. And Anne herself says in the diary, "Everyone made a rush at my diary. They felt that this was exactly the sort of thing that the Dutch minister meant." So right around then, Anne went back and began revising the diary from the beginning. By now, she was writing mostly on loose sheets of colored paper, something like 320-something sheets of colored paper. And she added things, she changed things, she wrote new sections and put them in. So really, the diary we read comes mostly from that revision. So in other words, there was the original version which she wrote, and then her revision. And then after the war, when Otto returned, first he just typed up a bit of the diary to give to his family in Switzerland. And then when he himself realized that she had wanted it to be published, and when he began getting responses to what he was showing people, he made a version which combined her first draft and her revisions, which is the version that most of us have read.
You have a very close reading of this. You contrast some of the entries, the earlier entries, and then their later revisions. Talk about how Anne Frank's voice developed, how it matured.
Well, all sorts of things. I mean, for example, the decision to call the diary Kitty wasn't made until 1944. So when we sit down to read the diary, the letters addressed to Kitty begin very early on, "Dear Kitty, dear Kitty, dear Kitty." But it wasn't until 2 years afterwards that she decided that she wanted to call the diary entries Kitty, so she went back and changed the entries in that way. Many of the early events, I mean the memory of the day that her sister was called up for deportation, the first weeks in the attic, in the early version, first of all, she was a little girl. I mean, if you look at the documents, she was writing in a kind of little girl printing. And also she was confused, she was miserable, her whole world had been destroyed, really upended. So many of the early entries, although they have a great deal of power and charm, are not as articulate as they might be because she herself was so bewildered by what had happened to her. So when she went back and changed it, she made everything clear and easy to follow and very lucid. I mean, likewise, the boy upstairs who figures so heavily in the diary, by the time she was revising, she was quite tired of him, so she changed the most blatantly emotional, romantic sections, or took them out, really, and just kept the more platonic sections so that you would think that he was just really the upstairs neighbor, the boy upstairs. But then when her father came along, he realized wisely that teenage romance was a good thing to have in the diary, so he put those sections back in.
Yeah. Now, talking about Otto Frank, he comes back from the camps. He's the only one of all of them to survive. Miep Gies shows him the diary. Describe the scene for us.
She gives him the diary, and he goes into what was his former office when the business was going, and closed the door and began reading the diary, and at some point, he called out to Mies and said, "Would you please hold all my telephone calls?" And she said she would. She understood that. And he read it, you know, it took a very long period of time. And there are all kinds of wonderful quotes from Otto in which he says that in the diary he discovered a daughter he never knew because she was so much more mature and complex and profound and had so much of a more intense spiritual sense of things than he'd ever realized.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that spiritual sense of Anne Frank.
Well, she was a believer. I mean, she believed in God. She, you know, the family was very assimilated, and there's been, again, a great deal of controversy about how Jewish was Anne Frank or how much Judaism remains in the diary. Well, the answer was that she was very conscious of being Jewish. She was very aware that the reason they were in that attic was because of Hitler's laws and because they were Jews. So there was no question in anyone's mind, regardless of whether they celebrated Hanukkah and St. Nicholas Day, she knew quite well she was Jewish. But she believed in God. I mean, some of her entries in the diary talk about God, and when Peter, again the boy upstairs, had moments of doubt or moments in which he said that after the war he would pretend not to be Jewish or deny the fact that he ever was Jewish. She was quite horrified by that.
I have always wondered about Otto publishing this diary. I have thought, I've wondered, in some way it seemed almost that it was incestuous for him to publish something that was so intimate of his daughter. I've wondered at his, you know, whether he was in it for the money. You recount all that he's been accused of, prudishness, too ready to forgive the Germans, that he censored Anne, he was anti-Semitic, he was sentimental, he was a coward, he had greed and personal ambition. You really do a great job, I think, of rectifying this view of him.
Poor Otto. Poor Otto, to have gone through that and then so much more. I mean, in fact, the point at which I think that he decided that the diary should be published was the point at which Anne herself wrote that she wanted the diary to be published. So it wasn't as if he were exploiting the private writings of his daughter. These were writings that she very much wanted to go out into the world. She had plans for it. She rewrote it with an eye to that. So that charge, I think, is baseless. Also, he was a terrific editor. I mean, if you look at the first version and the second version and then the third, which he put together, his choices were really very good, very exacting, economical and yet precise. He kept what was necessary and eliminated a lot of things that weren't necessary. So in that sense, he was very good, too. I mean, also, you know, in 1995, the definitive edition of the diary came out, and it restored, I think, there was like a third more material in this 1995 version than was in the 1995 version that was in the 1952 version, the original. And so there was a great fuss about it that was made about it, as if Otto, the censor, had removed all these sections. And some of them were about Anne's feelings about her body, about sexuality, how she felt about her parents' marriage. But because she's never really been taken seriously as a writer, and because so few people have bothered to look at the critical edition to see what she did and how she revised it, it was not often pointed out at the time that the sections that were quote-unquote restored were sections that Anne herself had taken out of her revisions, because once she had decided that this was to become a public document, all those intimate parts about her body and sex and her parents and so forth, she herself wanted taken out. She didn't want those being read.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Francine Prose about her latest book, Anne Frank, The Book, The Life, The Afterlife. And this book, of course, is about much more than the diary itself. You move from the diary to its reception and its transformation through the play and the movie. There's the incredible story of Meyer Levin. Tell us about Meyer Levin, who he was, and the controversy that he in some way embodied, that was a larger controversy around the character of Anne Frank.
Well, it was such a long and convoluted and fascinating saga, really. Meyer Levin was an American writer. He was present at the liberation of Bergen-Belsen, where Anne died, and Jewish. And as he stood over the mass graves of Bergen-Belsen, he thought to himself that a voice was going to arise from among the dead to tell the story. And then when the diary, he was living in France, when the diary was published in France, his wife gave him a copy of the diary, a gift that she would live to regret. He became really very obsessed by the diary and convinced that he was the person to adapt the diary for the stage. He wrote to Otto Frank. They became friends. When the diary finally came out in the United States, again in 52, he arranged to get the assignment to review the book on the front page of the New York Times Book Review. I mean, it's not necessarily a great idea for a friend of the editor's, and also Meyer Levin was trying to sell the book to Hollywood. So in other words, he was not only Otto's friend, but he was actively agenting the book, and he reviewed it in the Times, wrote this front page rave, and it became an instant bestseller. Of course, thanks to his rave, the book became a bestseller, and you know, it's impossible to know what would have happened without it. In any case, once the book was successful and people became interested in adapting it for the stage, Meyer Levin was progressively edged out of the negotiations because some very famous writers Lillian Hellman, Carson McCullers, Arthur Miller were being talked to adapt it. So his bitterness, in some cases understandable bitterness, about having been removed from the proceedings, led to lawsuits and accusations of betrayal and accusations of conspiracies and all sorts of things that went on for years and years and years.
Yeah, there's actually been a book written about that by somebody who I know personally. I've been friends with him and his wife, and he lives right here, Ralph Melnick.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes Meyer Levin's part, because what he says, and I think this is where some of the controversy over the portrayal of Anne comes in, through the play and the movie. The controversy is over Anne as a universal figure versus Anne as a Jewish victim of the Nazi Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, there's actually four books that have been written on the subject, one by Meyer Levin himself. And that's a very, I mean, that controversy is an interesting one, and it's certainly, when the play was being written, I mean, the assignment finally went to this team of Hollywood screenwriters, Francis Goodrich and Albert Hackett, and who had adapted Father of the Bride and It's a Wonderful Life and so forth and so on, and who were known for having a light comic touch. There was pressure on them to make it more universal, because it was felt that the more Jewish it was, the less popular it would be, the less people would pay money to buy tickets. So that did happen. That certainly wasn't Meyer Levin's fantasy or Ralph Melnick's fantasy. There's an additional question, which is, you know, at some point Meyer Levin believed that this was a Stalinist conspiracy, that Lillian Hellman's communism somehow led, you know, was part of what was behind this, whereas I think it was more likely a capitalist conspiracy, that someone understood how, you know, was trying to maximize the profits, to put it baldly.
Francine Prose talking about her new book about Anne Frank and her diary. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Francine Prose about her latest book, Anne Frank, The Book, The Life, The Afterlife. Just before the break, we were talking about the play of the diary. I asked Francine Prose how the book and the movie of the diary portray Anne Frank and how faithful that is to who she really was.
In both, really, she's this kind of bright, perky, unfailingly cheerful, you know, adorable young woman. I mean, it's very hard, I think, either from the play or the movie, to get a sense of how brilliant she was, because there's only, you know, a minimal, it's dramatized, so there's only a minimal use of her own language, of the text itself. So you really, you know, the achievement, and I think that's part of the reason why her achievement has been underrated, really, to a certain extent, is that you get the sense of this innocent girl scribbling away in her book and somehow managing to put together a diary, but you get very little sense of what an artist she was.
Yeah, but that's perhaps less an issue because it's a movie and they don't use so many lines, as also the need to somehow Americanize her, to make her, I think it was called by Ian Buruma, kind of, the instrument of a kitsch absolution of the Holocaust, this kind of, you know, the indomitability of the human spirit idea.
Right. Well, sure. And then that line from her diary, "I still believe that people are really good at heart," which is used at the end of the film and the end of the play and so forth, which is, as Cynthia Ozick said, torn from its bed of thorns. I mean, in the diary, her spirit is veering back and forth between some sort of hope and some sort of despair and a vision of the world, everything turned dark and destroyed, really, and then this hope about the human spirit. Because Anne had a really very mature and balanced view of what was good and bad about human nature. But the desire to make her see only the good and to have us see the good and see this redemptive, positive spirit emerging from all this horror led to a certain extent to the way the play was shaped and then the film.
Yeah, and I'd like to just read a little bit of that section. She says, it's really a wonder I haven't dropped all my ideals because they seem so absurd and impossible to carry out. Yet I keep them because in spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I simply can't build up my hopes on a foundation consisting of confusion, misery, and death. I see the world gradually being turned into a wilderness. I hear the ever-approaching thunder, which will destroy us too. I can feel the sufferings of millions. And yet, if I look up into the heavens, I think it will come all right, that this cruelty, too, will end. So, as you say, that's the goodness of the human heart on a bed of thorns, and a very powerful.
Right. Well, right, a little more balanced than I still believe people are really good at heart.
Right. Then you went to Anne Frank's house at 267 Prinsengracht, and you met some young people who did take her message of hope very much to heart. And it seems to have maybe given you a more nuanced version of the Americanized version of
Anne Frank. Well, you know, to a certain extent, I felt the same way. I mean, it irritated me to some degree to see her horrible fate being used as a kind of story about tolerance, since quite the opposite had happened to her. I mean, she was murdered, and she was murdered by hatred. But then when I went to Amsterdam and I saw these kids, really, who were using the Diary of Anne Frank, I mean, there's the Anne Frank House Foundation in Amsterdam and the Anne Frank Funds in Basel. Both are two human rights foundations connected with the diary, and they have programs all over the world. I mean, the one in Amsterdam brings Anne Frank's diary to places in Eastern Europe and Central America and South America and works with people to talk about the diary, to try and help people who would never be in conversation. For example, in Argentina, former victims of the dirty war and the children of the perpetrators of the dirty war, to have them come together around the diary. So once I met them and I began to understand this, I thought, you know, it's actually better to go out in the world and try and do some good than to sit there and say, oh, I think the diary is being used for the wrong purposes.
And your last chapter in the book, Anne Frank, the book, The Life, The Afterlife, you talk about teaching Anne Frank, something you yourself have done. How is it generally taught? What did you find was the emphasis?
Well, it's taught, you know, it's taught all different sorts of ways. I mean, it's taught as a diary of adolescence. It's taught as something about the Second World War. It's very hard for teachers. I mean, one of the things I discovered in the research was how difficult it was for teachers in many cases to talk about the Holocaust because it's so horrific, and students are so disturbed that teachers really have to face that, and it's very challenging and difficult. So in some cases, the book is taught essentially out of its historical context, you know, with only minimal mention of what Anne was doing in that attic. But I decided, and often it's taught in junior high schools and high schools, but I teach at Bard College, and this was in 2007. I was working on the book. I was really kind of obsessed with the book, and I was teaching a class at Bard, and my students there are wonderful. This is a wonderful class. And so I asked them to read the diary just so I could see how they responded. And these were smart, educated, well-read students. And their response to the diary was so personal and so emotional and so direct that I just essentially transcribed what happened in that final class and made that the last chapter of the diary.
Yes, they have wonderful, wonderful essays in there. Yeah, now, one of the books, and I believe the first book that we interviewed you about on Writer's Voice was Reading Like a Writer, which is a wonderful book of how reading literature, teaches us how to write better. So I want to ask you, in reading Anne Frank's diary, what lessons did you derive as a writer from that study?
Well, you know, I one of the reasons I went back to reread it was that I was working on my last novel, Golden Grove, which was written from the point of view of a 13-year-old girl. And I thought, well, following my own advice and reading like a writer, I might as well read the best thing ever written about a 13-year-old girl, which was The Diary of Anne Frank. And, it's hard to describe exactly how, because the lessons are never quite so easily traceable, but being submerged in that voice, really, and spending all those pages in her company reminded me of many things of what it was like to be that age. I mean, of course, I lived under entirely different and much more pleasant circumstances, and the character about whom I was writing had a different situation altogether. But the way in which a kid that age looks at the world came back to me in many ways after reading the diary.
Especially in her relationship to her parents, charming, I'd say, bravado in some ways, or defiance, and her adoration of her father, her competition with her mother.
Her intelligence.
Well, Francine Prose, thanks so much for writing this wonderful book.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You can hear our earlier interviews with Francine Prose about reading like a writer and also about her recent novel, Golden Grove, at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Amira Haas about her mother's diary of Bergen-Belsen. When Israeli journalist Amira Haas was growing up, there were a few stories her mother told her about her experience in the Nazi concentration camp Bergen-Belsen. Like the one about how her mother, Hannah Levy Haas, helped organize the women in her barracks to demand an equal sharing out of the meager portions of watery soup they were allotted per day. But Amira Haas never learned the whole story of her late mother's imprisonment until she read her Diary of Bergen-Belsen. Published now in English, the book has a foreword and afterword written by Amira Haas. It's a searing tale of extreme deprivation, starvation, and brutality, but also of the undaunted courage of one young woman who kept faith with her moral convictions in spite of soul-crushing circumstances. Amira Haas is renowned for her newspaper columns on the conditions of Palestinians living under Israeli occupation. She works for the Israeli daily Haaretz and lives in Gaza. Both her parents are Holocaust survivors, and both were longtime activists in opposing Israeli government policy toward Palestinians. Amira Haas, your mother grew up in what would become Yugoslavia after the war. She was a lifelong leftist, and during the war, or when Yugoslavia was invaded by the Nazis, she wanted to join the anti-Nazi partisans, but she didn't. Why was that?
She was in a small city in Cetinje, where she was in Montenegro, one of the would-be republics of Yugoslavia, where she did find the job as a Jew. She didn't find a job in Belgrade area because she was Jewish. And there she wanted to join. She was already part of a group before the Nazi occupation, the German occupation, there was Italian occupation. So she already contacted some partisans. But then when the Germans invaded Yugoslavia in those parts that had been occupied by the Italians before, she was contacted by two members, I think, of the Jewish community. They knew of her intention to go and join the partisans. They were afraid that they would all be murdered by the Germans as retaliation for her joining the partisans. And she had to make this, even though it was already 43 then, and even though it was clear for everybody that death was actually what the Germans prepared for all the Jews anyway, she couldn't take this upon herself. So she didn't join the partisans. She joined the group, the Jewish group that was later apprehended, of course, by the Germans. I mean, was ordered and arrested and then sent to Bergen-Belsen. At that time, if she wanted to join the partisans, it was not in order to save her life. It was actually about anybody who joined the struggle against the German occupation did not do it for survival reasons. So for her, it was not a question of survival. It was a question of how to deal with your death, in a way. So she couldn't take the responsibility of maybe one of those, I mean, if that somebody would have been murdered, and this murder attributed to her joining the partisans. I mean, she couldn't.
Now, she ended up in Bergen-Belsen. She survived nonetheless, and in fact, in Bergen-Belsen, she kept a diary, which in itself is an extraordinary thing. I mean, that...
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I'd say why that would have been so unusual.
First, it was difficult. I guess technically it was difficult to get writing material, and she managed to find, I mean, now I'm sorry I never asked her for more specifics, but she got a paper here, a paper there, a piece of pencil here and there. And then it was death penalty because the Germans would not allow people to be active in anything which was human. For example, she also took the kids of her barracks where she was interned, and the Yugoslav kids, Yugoslav Jewish kids, and ran a school actually for kids, and this was also forbidden. So everything had to be done away from the knowledge not only of the Germans, of the Nazis, but also of all their collaborators. I guess it was, you know, people remained human. Even in these unhuman conditions, people remained human.
And in fact, you know, she had a very deep ethical sense, and she writes, "I'm firmly and deeply persuaded that those for whom ethical principles represent primordial laws and have really become their human instinct, that these people are not doomed to disappear completely. They will not perish. They will not succumb."
Yeah.
She says, "I am equally convinced that I too will preside over my own situation in the end by maintaining my principles, by allowing my humanity to triumph." That's a very powerful, powerful statement. Do you feel it was, in fact, her ethics that kept her alive?
I think that at the end she's even more skeptical of herself. I think this was written earlier, but I don't remember because I tend to forget. It's a sort of repressing. I mean, it's very difficult to know, to remember it when you know it's your mother. But I think that at the end she was more skeptical about human humanity and herself. Yeah, of course, she always remained ethical in the sense in her actions in life, in her... For example, when she came to Israel, and she came because as a refugee, not as a Zionist, she was offered, like many other Jewish refugees who came to Israel, Jewish immigrants, she could move and live in the house of Palestinian refugees. It was 49. She wasn't yet aware of the scope of the Palestinian Nakba, of the Palestinian catastrophe, but her instincts told her that it's not done. She said, "I'm myself a refugee. How could they take the house of other refugees?" And she never moved to this house, unlike most of the Jewish immigrants. So yes, you could say that ethics and morality was a very natural component in her life.
And a component, you know, we of course have many examples of people who, because of their ethics, their lives were sacrificed. Many people say that you could only survive in the camps by being ruthless, and she's really a contrast in this way. In fact, she talks about at a certain point she and her fellow barrack mates mount a kind of strike. Talk about that. It's I've never heard of something like that.
Yeah,
it's extraordinary.
That's really amazing. And indeed, this was one of my childhood stories, you know, even before I could read. And I'm very proud of it, of course. Those who were in charge of distributing the meager food that everybody received, I mean, we cannot even call it food, so they always had their people to favor and to prefer and to give them some more of the content of this soup that everybody got. So what she and others decided that they would distribute the soup and evenly, so everybody would get the same portion and the same portion of some content that was in the soup. So this is indeed remarkable, and it succeeded. The fact is that it succeeded. So those who say that only selfishness works in such conditions, maybe they are mistaken.
And this whole idea of equality that really motivated her, I mean, she also writes in the diary about a post-war world, I think like many others, young people like herself, during World War II, they foresaw a post-war world where of greater equality. And then she moves to Israel, as you said, and she finds a world of inequality, and this time one in which it is the Israelis who have the upper hand. and are doing things that are not just towards the Palestinian population. How did this, you know, how did she struggle with this? What did she do? How did she confront this issue?
Maybe first we should mention that she left Yugoslavia against her own will, but she decided to, because she felt her experience and her life's experience during the Holocaust and in concentration camps was not really taken seriously by her peers in Yugoslavia itself, and she felt, I think, a terrible void, and most of her family had been murdered. That's why she moved to Israel, and as a refugee, and also with the hope that there she could build, like, futile hope of many others, that they could build socialism over there in Israel. And of course, she realized very quickly that it wasn't so. She herself joined the Communist Party in Israel very soon. And luckily, in Israel, the Communist Party was dissident. It was not like in Soviet bloc, where it was the governing party, the ruling party. So it had its contradictions, of course, because they all denied what was known already about the Soviet Union. It's an interesting psychological process. But I think that she was, but by joining the Communist Party, which was at times very unwelcome in Israel, the main stress was indeed on rights for Palestinians. And this was in ways of living together with Palestinians and working with them and going to demonstrations together and meeting with them and publishing literature and magazines together and bringing to the attention of everybody the fact that the majority did not want to know about the discrimination of the Palestinians in Israel, Israeli citizens, and the plight of Palestinians in 48. So, she continued in that sense. And then she joined also the feminist movement in the early 70s and was very active.
In her activity, and you yourself have been, of course, that's what you are noted for, is your own journalism, your powerful journalism in reporting on the plight of Palestinians in Gaza. You write that she as well, and I hear your voice in this as well, that she demanded a halt to what she called the merchandising of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
And the Holocaust has become a political asset for the current Israeli or past Israeli policies against the Palestinians. So whenever you want to justify what is the oppression and repression of Palestinians, Israeli officials and non-officials use the Holocaust. They say, allude in one way or the other to the Holocaust. And whenever Israel wants to defer any criticism of its actions, it refers to the Holocaust. When my mother used and my father used this term, they meant it was in 82 when Arafat was compared to Hitler. It's not only this portrayal of a leader and the people that Israel is pressing, the Palestinian people, but it's also kind of denial of the Holocaust, because if you compare Arafat and the Palestinians to the Nazis, then you really belittle the Holocaust to a frightening degree level. So it's manipulating the ignorance of people of what the Holocaust was, which was, I don't even use the term, it is the industrial, it was an industry of murder, a planned industry of murder. And this is the uniqueness of the Holocaust, of the Nazi system. So, of course, they use the Holocaust and they use the name of the memory of our families, murdered families, in order to justify occupation, in order to justify colonization of the territories, in order to justify attacks, military attacks such as was against Gaza. And this is so disturbing. It hurts the memory of our families, and it makes the history. It makes the history into cheap merchandise.
Mm-hmm. Your mother, as having gone through the horrendous experience of Bergen-Belsen, suffered extreme deprivation, starvation, sick with typhus. I mean, she really barely survived. She was a skeleton, practically, at the end of the war. Did she feel betrayed by this manipulation of the Holocaust to justify what she saw as oppression in her name?
By accident, she came to Israel. And then when she realized that Israel is turning into... When she couldn't bear it anymore, and it was immediately after the Lebanon war against Lebanon in 82, did she decide to look for... And she moved to Paris. She managed to move to Paris. She was already 70 by then, imagine. So it was not a usual age for a person to emigrate again. And she stayed 10 years in France. I think she was not very... She was very restless. I think that after Bergen-Belsen, she became very depressed. And she didn't find rest in any place. And she kept moving and looking for places. And she returned eventually because she needed to be closer to her family, which was me.
She told you some of her experience. Your father also was a survivor of the camps. He was in Auschwitz, is that
right?
No,
he was in a ghetto.
But he was also a survivor of terrible deprivation during the war. And he didn't tell you much at all. Going over your mother's diary after her death, And within the context, actually, of your own reporting, of your own experience now, I mean, it seems very much that this is, in some way, a meditation. Your own writing in this diary, you write the foreword and the afterword, is a meditation on comparing these two oppressions, the oppressions of the Jews during World War II, and maybe not comparing the oppressions, but seeing it through the lens of what's going on now. Could you talk a little bit about that, that lens that you shine on it in the light of your own work?
Yeah. Again, parallels and comparisons, they come up by themselves because it's us, because that's, as my father used to say, I've been through fascism and Nazism. I was not in South Africa. So he makes comparisons. He knows it's not the same. I mean, it's not at all. It's not the same regime. But that's when we analyze the motivations of the regime. And one should not forget again. And this was industrial manufacturing of death. This was the aim of the German regime. So one should not forget this. While the Israeli occupation is not about the end product, the planned product is of course not murder. It's a combination of colonial regime and apartheid regime, but there is also democracy mainly for Jews, and it's very different. But when we speak about suffering, I think this is what I with the time I realize more. Their experience, my parents' experience, made them very vulnerable to any suffering, very attentive to the suffering of the Palestinians. Even my father once told me, he said, okay, with us it was 5 years and over. It was terrible, it was murder, it was death, and it was over. But with the Palestinians it goes on, the suffering goes on all the time. So, okay, suffering which does not necessarily bring mass death, but it's suffering, it's people deprived of so many basic things in life, not just its land, its independence, its state, but it's also the freedom of movement, it's the decision to the free decision to study or to work, where to go, whom to marry. They're deprived of so many things. And this is about this unjust suffering that is caused in order to maintain the privileges of another people. And this was unthinkable, I mean, really very repulsive for both my parents, as it is for me and many other Israelis.
The Goldstone report came out recently, which detailed the suffering of the Palestinians at the hands of the Israelis in the last incursion into Gaza. Mm-hmm. It also talked about crimes that were committed on both sides, but it clearly shows that in terms of the scale, the extent of the destruction that more was visited upon the Palestinians than vice versa. Do you feel that the tide is beginning to turn? I mean, Goldstone is Jewish. You are Jewish. Parenthetically, I am as well. In the Jewish community itself, do you feel that there's beginning to turn a tide to a greater recognition of the need for fairness?
I want to hope so. I still think that, people are afraid to, or how would I put it? It's important to remember that the onslaught on Gaza was possible because of a certain policy of 20 years, which actually disconnected Gaza from the West Bank, from the attention of Israelis, and it's not something new, and made Gazans into an abstract enemy that one related to only either as a target of Israeli humanitarian actions, like allowing to pass to Gaza some food or medicine, or as the monstrous abstract of a terrorist which launches rockets. This was very different 20 years before, I mean, up to 1991. Gazans were real people for most of the Israelis. So this onslaught where Gazans where Israel could do things that give a completely different version about it without many soldiers really to contest the reality, this is not something which came out of nothing. It has its history. So I think that there are Israelis who knew that already before the onslaught and were against the onslaught. Their voices were heard, were hushed in the States, I think, more than they were heard, and they were heard in Israel. I would have liked it to be much more, much stronger, but there were voices against the onslaught while it took place. And a lot of activity of different Israeli groups against the onslaught and in order to collect information about it, which really annoyed the Israeli authorities. As it comes to America, I was in J Street and I felt, I mean, just one, the first session, the opening session, my impression was that people still do not dare to tackle the onslaught itself in public. Maybe I'm sure that in closed meetings they did. But as far as I remember, there was no, but maybe I'm wrong, there was no direct address to Gaza, to the attack on Gaza, and to the report. But I think that this is one of the great achievements of the report, Goldstone's report, is to force a debate, both in Israel and both among American Jewry and other parts of the world, not necessarily Jews. Because all the media talk about it, forced a debate which Israel hoped not to have. And this is by itself an achievement.
Well, Amira Haas, you've been a very crucial voice in bringing that debate to the public eye, to the public ear. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Amira Haas has just received the International Women's Media Foundation 2009 Lifetime Achievement Award for her reporting from Gaza. You can hear and read her acceptance speech by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.